Welcome everyone to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. Today we're talking about a topic that affects nearly everyone in the United States, education. Our task today is trying to determine whether the US education system actually educates students or merely signals to employers that certain individuals have a greater capacity to tolerate the intolerable. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Brian Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan is a professor of economics at George Mason University and a New York Times bestselling author. He has published articles in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and The Atlantic, and has provided economic commentary on ABC, BBC, Fox News, MSNBC, and C-SPAN. Professor Kaplan has written many influential books, such as The Myth of the Rational Voter, which was named the best political book of the year by the New York Times. He also wrote Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Open Borders, and the book we will be discussing in great detail today, The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. Professor Kaplan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Professor, we're happy to have you on today. We're going to take a deep dive into your book, The Case Against Education, a book I encourage everyone to go out and buy because it is just so illuminating to what is actually happening.
Yeah, definitely.
In the American education system. But before we get into all the arguments outlined in the book, why don't we have you talk a little bit about the book and why you decided with your elevated status to sort of blow the whistle on the industry you're a part of.
Right. So I would say that education is the social science topic I've been thinking about for the longest, really from the time I was in kindergarten. I was confused and puzzled by what was going on. Why do we have to go and learn these things? Why are these the things that are a part of the curriculum? And when I asked adults, they would just say, well, you got to do this stuff. You got to get good grades and do well in school if you want to get a good job. That seemed to check out, but then that pushes the question back. Why? Why is it that I have to jump through these hoops to do this stuff? And as I got older, I came up with a simple version of the view that I now hold. And it's, again, this idea, well, you're jumping through hoops in order to impress people. And if you don't do it, then you look bad. When I started studying economics, I found out that my idea had already been worked out in a lot of detail by economists like Michael Spence. But I looked more and found out, really, they've only done the theory. There's hardly anyone that is energetically defending this as the true model that actually describes education in the real world. Right. And that's what I really wanted to do in this book is say, look, this isn't just a cute little story that you can do some math on and get a Nobel Prize for. This is what explains an otherwise totally baffling industry and moreover explains life. Because since education is such an enormous part of our development, you start doing it when you're a young child. And these days you keep doing it until you are well into adulthood. You put that all together and say, look, this is not only just a puzzling industry, it helps us understand our whole position in the universe. So that's a lot of what motivated me to want to write this book, is to bring together the story and to tell people this isn't just idle theory. This is something of great importance in real life.
Yeah. You state in the book that while your conclusions on education certainly are contrarian, Your evidence is not, you say our education system is a big waste of time and money, that there is too much education, that there is not too little education, that there is way too much education, and that it's shocking to you that every politician wants to spend more money on education, especially when the returns are so terrible. And, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we've somehow arrived at this illogical conclusion that everybody should go to college because if they do, they will earn more money and live a better life. When in fact, all this does lead to degree inflation and a world full of Uber drivers and baristas with graduate degrees and student debt. I mean, that's pretty much where we're at. But before we get into all that, into the details, let's start at the beginning. Like, how did we get here? Why do so many of our leaders fail to understand that not everybody should go to college or even graduate high school?
Right. So towards the end of the book, I talk about one of my favorite neglected psychological phenomena, which is called social desirability bias. social desirability bias. It's a fancy phrase for an obvious thing, namely, when the truth is ugly, people lie and deceive themselves. So, you know, mundane version is, you know, am I fat? And of course, there's only one socially acceptable answer to that. Of course not. No, you're not. And that's the problem, is that when the truth is ugly, like, not only do people lie, but also eventually you hear the lie so much that it's like people just stop really thinking about it and just start repeating the lie, probably without any sense of dishonesty. I mean, I think this really explains what's going on with education. So it just sounds very ugly to say, look, some people don't benefit much from college, so they shouldn't go. And it's like, well, which people? Well, right. Like stupid people, lazy people, you know, like defiant people, right? And like I've just said a bunch of things that sound terrible, even though, come on, they're obviously true. There's stupid people, there's lazy people, there's defiant people. And yeah, having these problems makes it hard to do well in school, all right? So put it all together, it's the truth. And yet these kinds of ugly truths play basically no role in politics. It's essentially a competition between two sides to go and sugarcoat and engage in wishful thinking and hope that they can go and be the champions of this great poetry slam, which is politics. So that's my big story. Now, what's striking to me is that, you know, like I exclusively write books about very controversial ideas. I don't write any book about my normal views. I agree the sky is blue, but I'm never going to write a book about the blueness of the sky. It's just too boring to me, and it's already, you know, it's already well out there. But this is the one book that I write where I can go to a totally normal audience and have them nodding their heads in full agreement for three quarters of the talk. Almost everyone says, yes, of course, we spend a lot of time learning useless stuff in school. Yes, it's because of all this that we have to have degrees in order to do jobs that our parents or grandparents could have gotten with far fewer degrees. Yes, totally agree. And then finally, I say, and that's why we should have less education. And that's when people flip out and say, no. It's like, look, I've been leading you inexorably to this conclusion. And then when we get to the oasis in the desert with the water, and you just say, no, I'm not drinking that stuff. And I say, look, there's no other water around. This is what you, like, given that you've come all this way with me, what choice do you have? And yet people will just stonewall at that point. And I think that's a lot of what politicians would do as well, is say, yeah, like, so much of what you're saying is totally true, but we need to improve education. We can't cut.
Right.
And I say, like, so first of all, what makes you think it's going to improve? Anyway, look, like, the problem is people spending too much time, which causes this credential inflation. So you need fancy degrees to do quite menial jobs. And if we could just reverse this and have people get less education, then employers would be less picky about the credentials you need to be worthy of an interview. And things would go back to the better way they were before. Like,
right.
Really, it's very hard to avoid these conclusions.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to some of that, but let's first talk about what students are actually learning in school. You say in the book that from kindergarten on, students spend thousands of hours studying subjects totally irrelevant to the modern labor market. And, you know, how can this be? Why do they, you know, why do English classes, you know, focus on literature and poetry instead of business? When will, you know, a typical student use trigonometry? And, you know, what does any of this have to do with real life? Now, despite those words, you know, irritating, you know, probably every high school teacher and administrator, I think it's probably how 99% of the students feel out there. They're just bored with the material. And, you know, even if they can work past the boredom and do well enough to get through high school, they go on to even more useless coursework in college. And if they don't do well, then they fail out, and then they have no practical skills to, you know, enter the labor market. And you said something very interesting in the book where you said, you know, learning doesn't have to be useful. Learning doesn't have to be inspirational. But when learning is neither useful nor inspirational, how can we call it anything but wasteful? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my opinion,
amen,
that pretty much sums up the American education system. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I laugh, and you touched on this a little bit. I laugh every time I hear, you know, someone say, well, you know, and it's usually teachers or vice principals that say, you know, it's not that the students have to know this material specifically. It's that, you know, they need to learn how to learn or learn how to think. And, you know, my response to that is, well, if the subject matter doesn't matter, why can't the students decide what they want to study? You know, why can't they choose to study the history of baseball or why bungee jumping is fun? You know, it just seems that it's just ridiculous. You know, and I think you and I are on the same page here, but, you know, just for our listeners' sake, what do the data say about the applicability of the subject matter that's taught K through 12 and in college?
Right. Well, so I go at this in a few different ways. I don't think I ever actually found data on curriculum for K through 8, although we know that it's not too different from what you would do in high school. But anyway, so I've got good data on curricula for, in the US, for grades 9 through 12. And there I go over how, you know, so it's really a quite modest share that's being spent on literacy and numeracy and a very large share being spent on other subjects. And then when I look at college, again, show how, you know, less than 25% of bachelor's degrees are even plausibly or arguably vocational. So anyway, in terms of, you know, what we can say about this, we say, well, basically people are generally studying subjects that are they're not going to use on the job. And then really the only save is what you're saying of, well, it doesn't matter what you study, you're always building these mental muscles. And that's where I do rely heavily upon a large literature in educational psychology on what's called transfer of learning, where they actually do try to measure these indirect effects of learning. And the researchers are initially almost uniformly very sympathetic to this idea. I mean, they're educational psychologists. They want to discover that education has wondrous side effects. However, almost no one who's worked in this area comes away thinking that education actually does have much of a transfer effect. So, I mean, basically, like if you're lucky, students learn exactly the material that you're trying to teach them, and that's it. And usually, they don't even learn that. And you know, of course, even if they do learn it, they often don't remember it or apply it.
Yeah. Anyway, so, like, even if they did memorize the useless information, I mean, do they retain that knowledge? I mean, can they take that information and, you know, 20 years later do well on Jeopardy or something?
Yeah. So, well, a few people, I guess. But so that's a case where I turn to a very specific body of data. So, like, most of the time when we measure learning, we just test students at the end of the year or maybe at the end of a degree. But that doesn't really get to the question of how much do adults actually remember. So there I do track down a few studies where they actually give adults the kinds of tests that you would normally give students. And what you find is that retention is quite poor. And literacy and numeracy of American adults is considerably worse than almost any normal person would think. Right? It's just, you know, people's literacy and numeracy skills are embarrassingly bad, but they're not zero. For almost all the other subjects you learn in school, I think it's fair to say that what adults know is basically zero. American adults know near zero science, near zero foreign language, near zero civics, near zero history. The way that I put it is this: just write the very easiest test you can possibly imagine on these subjects. Questions like, does the earth revolve around the sun or the sun revolve around the earth? Real question from a real such test. So, you know, write up the questions that are as easy as you could possibly imagine, give them to a random sample of American adults, and American adults will probably get about half of them right. And that's what they know, which is essentially nothing.
So if the information is useless and the students don't even retain the information, would you say that our education is just a painful daycare for young adults?
Yeah. So there is that other story you're alluding to. Well, maybe it's inspirational. Maybe people are having a great Dead Poets Society experience. And for that, again, the data isn't quite as thorough as I'd like, but your common sense is clear as well as the data that we have, which is that hardly anyone enjoys school.
Right.
So, you know, again, not, you know, like there's plenty of people like the best teacher they ever had. They like that.
Right.
But just imagine like how many people would voluntarily spend time listening to an average American teacher? Right. So, you know, I think the way that I put it in my book is just imagine uploading the average American teacher's lectures to YouTube and seeing how many hits they get.
Right.
And like virtually no one on earth would watch this because it's incredibly uninspirational.
Right.
So, like it's just not true that students are having their horizons broadened often. Again, that doesn't mean that it never happens, but say most students just do not and never will have any appreciation for high culture. And even out of the people that do, usually teachers are just so incompetent at the job of inspiring anyone that, even students that would be inclined to like it come away saying, man, this was not a good experience.
That was brutal.
You could love Shakespeare, and yet how much are you going to enjoy a high school class where you read Shakespeare with students who can barely pronounce the words?
Right. So if we learn so little and it's largely useless information, why do employers value education so much?
Yeah, so that is the central mystery of the book. So if it was just a matter of we're wasting students' time and that's it, then that would be worthwhile to talk about, but it wouldn't be intellectually that puzzling. You say the intellectual puzzle is, why do employers care, for example, if you fail Latin? You're not going to use Latin. And my answer, which, as I suggested, comes from theorists like Michael Spence, is that even when what you're learning is actually directly irrelevant to the job, still the very fact that you did well in school certifies you, gives you a sign saying, look, if they could go and learn Latin well, they could probably become a banker. If they can suffer through this boredom, they could probably suffer through the boredom of being a banker, and so on. So basically, I say that the reason why education pays is that it is a way of convincing employers that you are worthwhile at least giving an interview to, and probably even hiring. Right. And that's the right story. Again, now, I never deny that school teaches some useful skills. So that's also
right.
Right. So a number of people have tried to put the silly view in my mouth that I think that school is nothing but signaling. And it does teach some useful skills.
I mean, writing, math. I mean, there are things that it teaches that we use on a daily basis, no matter who you are.
There is that too. Yeah. But that doesn't explain why employers care about your performance and everything else.
Right.
And that's where my story comes in. And I know you have a lot of arguments for why this makes sense. Just for example, failing versus forgetting. So if you fail classes, employers don't like you. But if you take classes, get A's, and then forget it, employers generally don't even care. If it's like, oh, wow, he's A+ in medieval history. Well, does he still know medieval history? Probably not. But I think that if you could do that well in medieval history, then he's a good person for our law firm to consider hiring. And that's the reasoning that I build on in the book.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about signaling. It's the primary thesis of your book, and it's, you take the view that education is not entirely, but for the most part, signaling, in essence, the sheepskin effect, meaning that
jumping through hoops.
Society does not reward knowledge, it rewards degree completion. Mm-hmm. And because employers have limited resources and they can't, read the minds, and they can't, know your entire background, they make, judgments about someone's productivity based on whether they did well in school and whether they graduate.
Yep. And trainability. That's important. Trainability is an important one too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, but a person with a 160 IQ who, is one credit short of completing a degree will have a much harder time mm-hmm. landing a job than somebody with 100 IQ and that extra class and degree in hand. So
too extreme, but just it's right. Yeah.
So can you talk about, go into detail a little bit about the signaling model versus the pure human capital model, which you talk about in the book?
Right. So there's a normal view, which is not entirely wrong, that says that you go to school to acquire useful job skills. This is called the human capital theory. Now, what's striking is that out of education economists and labor economists as well as a lot of development economists, but on top of that, of course, the politicians, teachers, parents, that's virtually the only thing going on in school is they're pouring useful skills into you. All right. So that's the human capital story. And again, you might think this is a straw man. Could it really be that there are experts in education who think that that's the whole story? And I've met a bunch of them, actually.
Really?
I've even met people who say that, human capital explains more than 100% of the career effect. And it's like, what? The idea here is that if you're really good at something, you would drop out and just get a job. So it's actually the worst people who stay in school. And so, in fact, you're sort of making yourself look worse, but you're also acquiring skills. So anyway, I've even met people who have that view. On the other hand, I've never met a single person, of course, me included, who thinks that education is 100% signaling, but I do think it's a high share. Anyway, so the key difference between the two stories, from the point of view of a selfish individual, it doesn't much matter, because they're both stories about how you go to school and it helps you, and helps you get a good job. The difference is from a social point of view. The human capital story says you go to school and you become more productive as a result, and then you get a better job. And that story says, well, you go to school, you get a bigger slice of the pie, but the reason you get a bigger slice is because you've made the pie bigger. And so it pays for itself. On the other hand, the signaling story says, yeah, you go to school, you get a bigger slice of the pie, but it wasn't because this, or at least not, a lot of it is not because the school made you more productive. You're not really producing nearly as much extra pie as you're getting. Rather, what you did is effectively lobby. Hey, give me a bigger slice. Give me a bigger slice. I'm good. Look, I'm convincing. See, I got this good sticker on my forehead. Give me the bigger slice of pie. I want more pie. Give me more pie. And that's what's going on. And key difference from the point of view of development economics, for example, is if the human capital story is the whole story, then countries can educate their way out of poverty.
Right.
We go and we say, look, we're Haiti. Like, we have low education. Let's just get a lot of education and then we'll become a rich country and us will be highly productive. My story says, no. What's going to happen if you go and pour a lot of money into education is you're just going to break the Haitian budget. And if they're not studying material that is useful in the real world, the people with more education will still make more money, but it won't enrich the country. So right. Basically, signaling says that education is a way to enrich the individual, but not society. Human capital says it's both.
Yeah, I mean, it's more likely that, you know, when countries get richer, they invest more in education rather than countries becoming rich because they invested in education.
Yeah.
You know,
right. I entirely and thoroughly agree.
Yeah.
There are a few papers. You know, there's a very small number of papers that consider this. If I recall, all of them say clearly, but again, those papers have gotten almost no play.
Right. Right. So, What are some of the like major critiques to the signaling theory? I mean, I think you're right. You know, I think you said what, like 70% of, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, like 70% of what we do.
80 is my best guess.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it may be more than that, but yeah. You know, I guess what are, you know, when you've been discussing the book and talking about this, what are some of the like primary critiques that you get?
So let me tell you, I'll start with the most common and then I'll work my way down to the best. The most common one is Brian Kaplan is a knuckle-dragging Neanderthal economist. He thinks that it's all about money and jobs. And the real purpose of education is to enrich human being souls and provide enlightenment. Right now, this critique does bother me, especially when they say he never considers this possibility, because if they just turn to the table of contents, they have a whole chapter on this.
Right.
So, you know, what I've said is, look, it's one thing to go and criticize a book you haven't read. We all do that, right? But it's another thing to criticize a book without reading the table of contents, which I think is pretty low.
Right.
So anyway, that's the single most common criticism I get, usually from humanities people, is just to say, you have never considered this. And like, well, I've got a whole chapter on it, so I definitely considered it. And again, my answer is actually, I agree with your aspirations. But just because school says they're trying to inspire love of Shakespeare, for example, does not mean they succeed. And in the book, I say, actually, really, we can take a look at the evidence and see there's almost no sign that schools succeed in providing inspiration or appreciation for high culture or anything else. So while it'd be great if it happened, it doesn't happen. And this is a terrible argument. So that's, again, probably the most common. Then there are... Then there are a number that I consider in the book. So, I mean, one of the main ones is just that anyone in education economics agrees with me, which is true, actually. So particularly anyone empirical education economics, like I said, there's a bunch of theorists who do this.
Right.
But then the amount of energy they spend defending the theory as relevant to the real world is almost nothing. I'm almost the only person that does it. So there's a few others, but the reason I could write this book is like, it's wide open. Hardly anyone wants to stake out this position that I have in this. There are, some papers that come up with much lower estimates of the signaling share. But what I do in the book is say, well, let's read these papers carefully and see what they really show. And a lot of it is that they don't actually answer the question that they sounds like they're answering. For example, there's one very good paper that says actually people who finish 4-year college degrees, then employers actually have a near perfect measure of their ability. Okay. And then they said, but for everyone else, not so. So anyway, like a lot of people have waved this paper in my face and said, see, you're wrong. And I say, look, read the paper. The paper at most only claims to describe a quarter of the adult population and says I'm right for the other 75%. And then secondly, if you look at their measure of perfect knowledge, it's nothing like that. It's actually, it's a measure of a lack of further learning, which is far quite different from perfect knowledge. I mean, the way I explain it in the book is, you know, my knowledge of Swahili is now at a lifetime maximum. I'm never going to improve. However, this does not show that I have perfect knowledge of Swahili. Far from it. I have reached an extremely low level, but I'm not going up. Anyway, the standard that paper uses of perfect knowledge is actually that Swahili standard of people stop improving, and then we're just going to call that perfect. It's not perfect. Right. Not even close to perfect. It's just as good as people, as good as it gets, which for all you know is terrible.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, just something that kept popping into my mind was, you know, Pink Floyd's "We Don't Need No Education, We Don't Need No Thought Control," and I was like, you know, this is so right, you know, and I guess my question for you is, why do we do it? You know, if after completing all the requisite schooling, we don't really learn anything, and we still need to be trained on the job in order to do the job. Why don't we just get rid of all the bullshit, get rid of the embarrassment, you know, anxiety that's thrust on us by, you know, educators, get rid of the insufferable subjects, you know, get rid of the insurmountable student debt that we now see ourselves in, and, you know, just say, hey, teacher, leave those kids alone.
Yeah. So, well, like the heart of the problem is this: from the point of view of any one individual, giving up on education is basically giving up on a high status career. Right. So we're just, you know, like every person is just one person. The world does not revolve around any of us. And so if one person just says, screw it, this is a waste of time, what happens to them, totally consistent with my model, is not that they get to have to live a great life. Instead, they just shoot themselves in the foot and they cut themselves out of a lot of great opportunities. So that's why individuals don't do it. Now, as to why societies aren't more reasonable. Well, since my first book, as you mentioned, is The Myth of the Rational Voter, I just have a general view that societies are terrible at choosing government policies. So I think that, like, almost everywhere you look, policies are awful. And, like, a little common sense would go a very long way. So then, like, why is it that common sense has not prevailed? So, you know, my story there is that common sense does not sound good. It does not speak to human emotions. What speaks to human emotions is like a pile of wishful thinking and saying things that sound good on the surface, right? So, you know, and in particular, no one individual, you know, like, has much control. You know, every individual has almost no control over the actual practical outcomes. What you can control is your own feelings. And, you know, most people feel better if they just, you know, put aside their doubts and just join and conform to what society praises and blames. Right. So, you know, I would very much compare it to religion, where I could say, whatever your views on religion, obviously almost all religions are false. You know, your religion might be true, but your religion doesn't have a majority of people because no religion does. Right. All right. So basically, if you say, gee, how can almost all human beings have been so wrong for so long? Right. And, well, if you can believe, whatever your answer is to that is my answer to what's wrong with politics. Right. So say politics is basically like a religion. It's a way where people turn off their critical thinking and join in with a tribe of like-minded fanatics, right? And that's what politics is. Sad, but it's not that puzzling, really. You know, like once you can just get over your sheer shock of, like, you go to a satanic church and say, like, what's going on here? They're worshiping Satan.
Right.
Once you can get over that shock, it's like, all right, I guess it's not so different from other religions in the grand scheme of things. Right. Or I don't know, like, I was just down in Central America, you know, seeing Mayan temples and saying, like, they're like sacrificing human beings for centuries to these gods that almost everyone today thinks of as totally made up, just like no more real than Magneto or the X-Men.
Right.
And, well, like you say, and yet they did it, went on for thousands of years and people went along with it. And so if that doesn't seem weird to you, then why should it be weird to you that every society on earth is blowing money on education that serves very little practical function?
Yeah. So it seems like you know, when we try to figure out like what the individual should do versus what the policymaker should do, you know, you had this example in the book where you said, imagine you want a better view at a concert. What do you do?
Yeah.
You stand up. And individually standing works. And then you ask the question, you know, what happens if everyone copies you? Can everyone see better by standing? And you said no. So if education is mostly signaling, which, you know, we're fairly confident that it is, and, you know, everyone's encouraged to go to college, which only makes the degree less valuable and defeats the purpose of getting the degree in the first place, you know, what should the individual do based on their abilities? And then, you know, what should policymakers do? Because from what you just said, it sounds like there's no benefit for policymakers to change course because they would just be pissing off a lot of people.
Yeah, or it's, you know, negative benefit. Yeah, so yeah. A policymaker who sticks his neck out and says the truth, people are probably not going to like you because almost everyone, you know, so like large majorities of people in every country ever surveyed think that there should be more spending on education. Or let me put it this way. That's not quite right. What is correct is that only a very tiny minority in any country at all that's ever been surveyed thinks there should be less. That's definitely clear. So hardly anyone on earth thinks there should be less. For example, like in the United States, even strong Republicans, only 12% of them think that we should spend less on education. Right. So, and if you're saying, like, isn't this like a whole industry that hates you and mocks your values and tries to brainwash your kids to think that you're the devil?
Right.
And you still don't want to cut their funding? It's like, well, but like we need to, right? So, you know, like if even they don't want to cut it, then you can really see that it just sounds terrible to people. So, you know, that's really, really the heart of the problem is that, you know, it doesn't sound good. Right. And again, this is far from the only such case, but, you know, like my main case for hope is, look, like step one is admitting we have a problem. So like, I just love to get in front of an audience and say, look, there are ugly truths. Are you seriously going to deny that there are ugly truths? All right. Well, how often do you hear politicians tell you any ugly truths? Like never. All right. Well, so what's going on? Well, they are lying. And why are they lying? Because you don't like people who say ugly truths. Like you've got to go and change your attitude about people who speak ugly truths and start to appreciate us. Yeah, because, you know, I do put myself in that category of people who speak ugly truths. And yeah, I suppose I get some kind of enjoyment out of it, I'll admit, although I'm not trying to upset people, but I do get a feeling of relief from just opening up my mouth and saying what seems to be plainly the case. And it's like, look, can't we just admit this?
Deep down they know. Yeah.
You know, just to like do it with some humor, it makes me feel so much better. You know, like, you know, so I'm someone who is always ready with a joke in any situation and say, look, come on.
Yeah.
Let's look at things. It's not what people are saying. It's not.
So you provide a good example of the one fewer degree. Mm-hmm. You know, you said if education certifies labor quality, society would be better off if we got less.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? And you know, is that possible? Can we go back somehow to, you know, the time when a high school diploma was the ticket? Because now it seems like you just have to have that master's degree to even, you know, get to the top of the pile of resumes.
Yeah, if I'm correct about education, then there's a very easy way to solve this problem, and that is for government to cut spending on education. All right, so there's a lot of research saying that if you make education more affordable and spend more money on it, people get more. And this research seems totally solid to me. It has an immediate implication. The way to go and have people get fewer degrees and spend less time in school is to spend less and make it less affordable. All right. Now, people immediately start panicking about how are we going to run a modern technological society if people don't have enough education. And that's where I say, well, remember what we were talking about how you don't really learn much in the way of practical skills in school? Since that's true, then you've answered your own question. Right. It's not true that we won't be able to be part of a modern technological society. Instead, we will learn how to go and run the society the same place we do now, on the job.
Right.
On the job is where almost all of the actual ability to go and handle the complex modern world is go. That's where people gain it. It's not in school. All right. So again, the idea then is if education were less affordable, on the one hand, it's scary because you say, I couldn't afford it anymore, quite possibly. But on the other hand, you wouldn't need it anymore. And that's the heart of it. Right. And again, when people are thinking about this, they're so focused on the one really smart kid from a poor family who gets to go to college these days and say, well, isn't that a much better system? And they don't pay any attention to all the siblings of that kid who drop out of high school, who in 1950 would have still had a lot of good career options and today are really stuck.
Right.
So again, when people start focusing on it so that we have a more just society, say, no, we don't. We have a less just society than we had in the past. Because right now we basically say, hey, everyone, you got two choices. Either endure a whole lot of boring, irrelevant schooling or be stuck with a low-skill job. That's what our super just society offers everybody.
Right.
Say thank you. Right. Whereas in the past, there were a lot more options just to get a job and work your way up, which I say is a much more fair system.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the affordability. I mean, it seems to me that the college loans have only made, you know, the cost of education go up and further burden society with student debt, because colleges view students as consumers. And when the government and, you know, other means allow them to borrow or access more money to go to school, they have increased purchasing power. So naturally, colleges raise the price of admission because they can. Mm-hmm. And then once that happens, the Department of Education says, you know, it's more costly to go to school, so let's increase the amount, you know, a student can borrow. And then colleges raise their prices again. And, you know, I think this is a vicious cycle that's taking place, but you know, you look at it a little differently. You say that the college is in fact way too cheap, and that this affordability through, you know, loans and other subsidies, you know, has made the labor market require us to have these additional degrees, since everyone's going to college and everyone's getting a bachelor's degree. But your view is that if we turn off the spigot, that the labor market would adjust.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, like if all the master's degrees disappear, employers cannot continue to say you have to have a master's degree to get this job. They got to say, well, we got to work with what we got.
Right.
Right. And, you know, they're still probably going to take the more educated workers, but again, it shifts things down. But yeah, my view on student loans, I think that they, you know, while there's a lot of problems with student loans, I would say this is actually the smaller part of the problem. I say the real problem is government support, right? So student loans, there's definitely some government support. Government's providing the guarantee. Government is making the interest rates lower. But this isn't nearly as bad as when the government just makes it free. So at least with a student loan, the student says, well, on the one hand, it's a low interest rate. On the other hand, I do have to pay it back. That gives some reason to go and consider, is this education really a good deal? But if the government says it's totally free, get all you want, taxpayer expense, that's where there's almost no reason to ask questions or second guess it. So again, I'd say that really this focus on student loans instead of government subsidies is really reflects the general, you know, excessive focus on the individual student relative to the overall effects in society. So yeah, it's like student loans, it like puts a burden on the individual student. Oh, that poor student, now they have to pay back all this money. Whereas the effect of subsidies on society of causing credential inflation and burdening taxpayers, that's one that hardly anyone talks about. And I say that's really the much bigger problem.
Right. You know, one thing I want to know is like what is the break even cost of college? I mean, we've been told that, you know, we need to go to college so that we can earn more money. And, you know, currently the data still seem to support this as long as you graduate. You know, if you don't graduate, you've wasted quite a bit of time and money. And, you know, that's a real problem. But it, you know, if you go to college and you graduate, right now, the increase in your lifetime earnings exceeds the cost of college. But, you know, I want to know, and probably what our listeners want to know, is at what point will the cost of college be greater than the additional returns to having that extra degree?
Yeah. So what I say right now is that if you're at the 75th or 80th percentile of American high school students, right? And remember, you need to go and think about, is, am I at a good school or a bad school? But anyway, if you're the 75th or 80th percentile for all American high school students, that's where I'd say is about the break point where college is a good investment for you. If you're weaker than that, if you're not in the top fifth or fourth of all American high school students together, then I'd say actually you're probably better off going and try to do something else. So yes, a lot of it, like you said, is that you need to take graduation probability into account. And yeah, the weaker of a student you are, the less likely you are to actually finish. And then there are a number of other factors to keep in mind, such as weaker students usually do the easier majors, and easier majors pay less. Right. And also weaker students usually go to less selective schools, and those degrees are usually not as good in terms of labor market effects. So, you know, like in the book, I actually have a whole separate section on never mind the effect on society. What's the best thing? What's the best plan for you? And that's where I do try to go over these numbers and say, I think actually, like even selfishly speaking, far too many kids are going to college right now because basically it's a very important decision that we put in the hands of children.
Right.
And then we combine it with enormous pressure from parents, teachers, government, and peers to go and do it without giving people a realistic assessment, you know, guidance counselors also. So, you know, like 50 years ago, it would have been very standard for guidance counselors to say, you're not college material. Why don't we consider trade school? And now I think you could get fired for that. If anything, right. A guidance counselor fired, it would be going and telling students that they should go to trade school and not, and that college wasn't for them because they're not college material.
but even like
student recorded that, put that up on YouTube or something, I think that really could be the end of your job, you know, teachers unions notwithstanding.
Right. But even like the students that, you know, do well, that are in that, you know, high percentile, you know, what increase in price of higher education has to happen before that person who says, no, I'm not going to college because I see that, you know, the price tag of college dwarfs my additional lifetime earnings from having the degree.
Yeah. So to dwarf, you know, so I'd say probably if the tuition you actually pay were to rise by or were to double, then you know, again, that would move it out a lot. So, you know, maybe, so again, like I actually have the spreadsheets where I could in principle do this, but I would say that
We're still a long way.
Like if you're right on the, if you're on the edge right now, and then your best option is to, so basically in the book, I focus on students who live at home and go to the nearest state school, say.
Yeah.
Right. And that tends to give you a pretty favorable numbers because you don't have extra living expenses. And you also, on top of that, pay quite reasonable tuition. But you know, like if the tuition were a lot more than that, so yeah. So I'd say, you know, yeah, I mean, if you're actually paying, you know, like 20-25,000 in tuition rather than, you know, like, you know, typical public school tuition, which, you know, by the way, it's important to remember that list price is not the same as what most people pay.
Sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I mean, here's the thing is that if you're part of the elite, you very often do not understand this properly, because elites actually very typically do pay full price. Even at private schools, they're quite likely to pay full price. But most kids at top private schools do not pay full price, and nationally, again, like most kids are not paying full price. So it's very important to consider that. Again, I would say this is one of the complaints about higher education that actually is overstated, because people are so focused on list price and the enormous increase in that, and they aren't really properly looking at the what we call net tuition, which is the price you really have to pay after all the discounts and everything else. So that has risen in percentage terms quite a bit less than the actual list price. So again, like I'm just much more focused on what are the benefits of education for society rather than this horrible burden on the one kid, which again, the one kid is much easier to go and sympathize with, but it's sort of missing the big picture of like our society is getting very little value out of this.
Yeah. I would imagine it's a tough sell to an audience to say, yeah, you know, college is gone up exponentially and it needs to keep going up.
Right. Yeah.
So, but you know, let's shift a little bit and talk about, you know, I guess the government's so-called break even, you know, there's gotta be positive returns to, having a more educated society. I would imagine that, you know, there's probably less crime and, you know, more people participate in the political process and, you know, maybe are happier. So where do we stand as far as the I guess the social returns from, you know, the education investments that we engage in?
Yes, this was probably the hardest chapter of the book to write because there have been so many different claims made about all the wonderful side effects of education. And the usual thing professors will do is just say, well, I'm not worrying about that stuff. I'm just focused on my one issue. But that's fine for getting a paper published, but it is not fine for advising the world about what the best course of action is. For that, you really need to factor everything in. And so I actually made a good faith effort just to factor everything in, which meant reading a giant stack of stuff. So looking at, so what is the actual effect of education on happiness, for example? What is the effect of education on the political process? What is the effect of education on health and so on, right? And crime. So out of all of those, the one that seemed most genuinely large was this crime effect. That's primarily just for high school because so few people that would go to college would be criminals anyway that it really doesn't change very much. But again, like that turns out to be a very complicated issue because then you got to say, well, so what price tag can we put on crime? And then how much is it likely to reduce it? So I go through all that and I do say that other people probably greatly overestimated the effect of education on crime reduction, but to still come away saying it's probably substantial. And I put that in. And then at the end, it comes down to for males that are bad students, that's probably the least bad case for giving them some more education. All right. And again, like, why males? Why should males get the money? Because males commit the crime. That's why.
Right.
So the benefit of reducing female crime is very small because women commit so little crime. Right. And again, if this seems unfair, it's like, well, I'm not doing the fairness calculation. I'm doing the cost benefit analysis. So cost benefit analysis says that if a group has a high problem and you can reduce their problem by 50%, that gives you a much bigger benefit than going and reducing the problem of a group that barely has a problem by 50%.
Right.
If you go and get priests to go and commit half as many murders, well, they're not committing many murders. But if you get gang members to commit half as many murders, that's a big gain.
Right. Right. Wow. So what should we do? Spending, I guess, less money on education as, from the federal perspective, what are a few things that our leaders can do to make it better, just the experience better for the individual and that of society?
So American education is primarily paid for by state and local governments. So like my advice is also to state and local governments. You guys spend less. In fact, it's the most important for you guys to spend less. Federal government should spend less as well. Right. And again, the idea of other than this, this is the big message of the book, spend less.
Right.
And we're wasting a giant pile of money. And honestly, when I had a friend who was saying, do you really think you're going to convince people to just drastically cut education spending? And I said, look, if I could just give a little bit of moral confidence to people that don't want to increase spending, I've done my job.
Yeah.
I could just make people who say we're spending, I don't want to spend any more on education, feel like they're doing something good instead of feeling like jerks. I think that's useful in itself. I do also talk about ways that you could get more value out of the spending that we're doing. There's actually a lot of evidence-based ways to do this. What's striking to me, though, is that most of them, the evidence has been around for a long time, and yet the school system pays almost no attention.
Yeah. If you're giving people more money, they're not going to try to figure out how to best.
Yeah, that's a lot of the problem. So it's not true that schools never change. They change a lot, actually, but they change basically on the basis of fads and whims and ideology. They don't change based upon actual pedagogical research, right? So, I actually found a paper that measured the effect of highlighting on student learning and came away saying there's no effect of highlighting on student learning. I remember I was at a parent-teacher night and the teacher said, and we're going to be doing a lot of highlighting in this class. And I was like, what would happen if I raise my hand and go and explain to her the content of this paper and then say, so therefore, I think that we need to eliminate all highlighting, and what would happen? And obviously the teacher would just go, oh, that's very nice. I wasn't aware of that. And then continue doing the highlighting.
Right.
So, and again, that's just a very small example of a general problem with the system is it's not evidence-based. Again, when people say are you criticizing teachers? And I say, look, teachers in my experience are extremely nice. They're nice people, but they are not logical.
Right.
They are not rational. They're not evidence-based. They're highly emotional. They're the kind of people where you say, look, I would trust them to go and be kind to a child. But if it's a matter of what will deliver concrete, measurable results, I would not trust the typical teacher at all.
Yeah. It's
the wrong attitude. They don't have an attitude of facts matter. Emotions must be set aside.
And yeah.
That is the attitude that has led to all of the progress we have in understanding the world, really. Facts matter, put emotion aside. And that attitude is sorely missing from especially the K-12 education system. And I would say, there's a lot of other evidence-based reforms you could do, such as just having more testing, right? Even testing that doesn't count for a grade. It's just very useful to give people feedback on whether they successfully mastered a skill or not.
Right.
Right. And once you say that, you kind of understand why we don't do so much testing, because you're hurting people's feelings and you're making teachers hurt people's feelings. They don't want to.
Right.
Just say, like, everyone's a beautiful little snowflake. and the tests don't really show anything. And like, yes, tests show a lot.
Right.
Some people know it all and some people know next nothing. And they also show whether the teacher has successfully turned someone who didn't know something into someone who does know something. And that's an ugly truth, but it needs to be said. Now, the main thing that I talked about in the book, where I think it's just gotten not nearly enough attention, is vocational education.
Right.
And again, this is another idea which common sense says makes a lot of sense. Take the kids that don't want to go and become professors, that have no interest in trigonometry, they don't care about history, and go and teach them how to repair cars.
Right.
Right. So
it's, yeah, I mean, you had the quote in the book about the class clown who asked, what does this have to do with the real life? Yeah. You say, he was on to something.
Yeah.
And I bet a lot of students, feel that way. And, it's almost torture to force those kids to learn this stuff or sit through this stuff.
Yeah, so, the Bill Gates Foundation did a giant study on high school dropouts and they came up with an amazing conclusion. The main reason people drop out of high school is because they're bored.
Yeah.
Wow, that's like multi-billion-dollar research there. But if it takes the Gates Foundation to make this obvious fact common knowledge, then I guess I'll thank the Bill Gates Foundation for doing it.
It's kind of
ridiculous. But anyway, what I say is that there is good research saying that vocational education delivers large benefits, especially for the people that don't like regular school, that most of the complaints about it actually are greatly overblown or wrong. And then on top of that, the benefits to society are even greater because you're at least spending resources to teach concrete skills, which make grow the pie, rather than just going and getting a certification saying, I went and learned Latin, so I deserve to get a job at your law firm.
Right. Right. Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
If you want to get more Brian Kaplan, his book, The Case Against Education, is available on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Brian's research, visit bkaplan.com. Professor Kaplan, thank you again. Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Indentured Students, Why We Need Less Education, with our very special guest, Brian Kaplan. Make sure to check out all the episodes of the Demand Side on the Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the Demand Side.